Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Paradox's class. It is August 14th, 2022. We have a special guest speaker today. Hugh Ross will not be here this week or next week. And so the next 2 weeks, we have my good friend, Ross Hoagland, going to talk to us. And his title, Perception, How We See the World and Why It Matters. Ross is a longtime RTB apologist and has delivered many speeches to us before, many talks, and I'm sure you'll find it intriguing at the very least. Ross, come take the podium. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good to see you. I'm so excited. It's been a while since I've been up here. I want to talk about a topic that I've never heard anybody talk on before. How's that? I'm opening with this verse rather than my title slide because I want you to think about this verse. For you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, my soul knows it very well. Psalm 139:13. Keep that verse in one side of your head while you look at all the slides with the other side of your head. The sound is really boomy. I know they'll fix it. No, they just made it worse. They'll fix it. Here's the title to my talk, Perception, How We Perceive the World and Why It Matters. And I want you all to meet... Well, I don't know where he is. There he is. David is my good friend who put this PowerPoint together. So if you think this is a cool presentation, afterwards shake his hand because he did the slides on this. I'm very, very impressed, and it's made it much more fun for me to do these talks. Okay, let's talk about my story about why I'm interested in this. This is a picture of our two dogs. Okay, this is Gunner on the left. He's a rescued, well, we got him from somebody who, he was a emotional support dog for a guy that was in the Vietnam War. That's why his name was Gunner. We kept the name. We had, at one point, we only had Gunner. And my wife, let's just say she wants more dogs than I do. So she calls me one day and she says, honey, I'd like to get another dog. I know it's a stretch for you, and I said, okay, but that's his name. So the little guy's name is Stretch. And I've only had dogs like one other time in my life. I've had cats. I've always been a cat person. I get cats. I relate to cats. Dogs confuse me. I don't understand them. But since we've had dogs, anybody who has dogs, we spend a lot of time thinking about, you look at them and you realize, even though there's millions of them and we all know them, they're very, very different than we are, aren't they? I mean, you take them out for a walk and they can spend 5 minutes smelling some other dog's poop. And somehow that's like the highlight of their day. It's really important. They must be getting some very important information from that. But they just do things really differently, right? They're a conscious agent. They think and walk and like much like us, we can sort of imagine what it would be like to be one, but they just respond to things very differently, right? My dog wants to go out in the morning, go outside to do his business, and I'm not going out if I don't have my clothes on, right? But he doesn't recognize that I don't have my clothes on. He's just looking at me like, why aren't you taking me out? So some things they get better than us. Some things they don't get at all, right? But this whole thing with the dogs got me thinking about how are people different from each other? How are we different from the animals? How do we perceive things? How do we see things? Do we see the truth about things? So for about a year, I've packed my brain with this stuff, and I've been thinking about it, and I thought, well, it's time to do something about it. Do a talk. Do a talk at Paradox. Okay, let's do it. Okay, this guy's an author that I disagree with on a lot of stuff, but he has a good quote. Your perception of the world is not necessarily the same as what is actually occurring. So let's get our terms correct. I want to define what I mean by perception. This is sort of an amalgamation of three or four definitions that I found on the internet. This is not, so I made this up. So it is the ability to receive information or data about something from the senses and form a mental impression of that thing. Okay, so I'm not talking about how you perceive something in terms of what do you think about it or your emotional reaction to it. I'm talking about the information that comes into our body through the five senses. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about perception. I'm hoping, I'm almost guarantee that when I am done with this talk, you will quite literally see the world differently than you do right now. How's that for a challenge? The several senses, let's go through them. We're all familiar with them, but you know what? I bet you haven't thought about them for a long time. Sight. Perception of an object by the eye, right? Hearing, process, function, or power of perceiving sound through the ears. Smell, to perceive the odor or scent through stimuli affecting the olfactory nerves in your nose. Taste, to perceive or recognize as if by the sense of taste. And then I'm leaving this one for last, types of touch. I got to thinking about this, and I realized our sense of touch really ought to be about 10 different senses. But we think of it as all of one. Let me go through the list that I made. I got some of them on the PowerPoint, and then I thought of some after, and they're not there. But let's talk about what are all the things that we think about that we call the sense of touch. Contact, okay? I come up, I put my hand on your shoulder. It's physical contact. You can sense that, right? Pain. Pain is touch. If somebody hits you in the head with a 2x4 because you weren't listening to them, that's pain.
That's abuse.
That's well, it depends on how negligent I was of them, I guess. Itch. That's a sense of touch, too. You get a feather or the blanket's just not right in the middle of the night and it's right in the middle of your back and you got to sit up and get your hand back there and scratch until it's satisfied, right? Tickle. It's a sense of touch too, isn't it? And this one's interesting because it's very much dependent on the circumstances. If your husband or wife affectionately touches you that way, you're going to feel a tickle. But if your coworker touches you exactly the same way, it's not going to tickle. It's just going to annoy you and offend you, right? But then there's some others. Physical lovemaking, that's a sense of touch, isn't it, with your husband or your wife? Texture, I can touch something. I can tell whether it's smooth or rough. That's amazing that we can do that. And then there's all these internal senses that we have that we call touch. Sense of pain, and something your head can hurt. Right? Is that a sense of touch? I don't know. To me, in my mind, it ought to be something else, but that's what they classify it as, so that's what we're going to think about. You can have stomach issues, right? Eat pizza 5 days in a row, you're going to feel it. Sickness. You start to get the flu, you know it because of the way your body feels. Is that touch? I guess so. Hunger. Feel hungry. We know what that feels like. It's a very specific sensation. Is it touch? I guess so.
Yeah.
Fatigue, you're tired, same kind of thing. So God's given us all these amazing senses, all these different ways of thinking about or feeling, interacting with the outside world and our inside world, right? Through the sense of touch. So I'm going to do this with 6 questions. I'm going to ask the question. I'm not going to answer it right away. You guys think about it, and at the end of each question, we'll answer it and go to the next one. So here's the first question. I got a bowl here of corn chips in a red ceramic bowl and a metal trivet. Okay? Do we perceive all the features that exist of that object? Is what we perceive complete? Okay? We can see it. We can hear it. Right? I feel it when I pick it up. I can smell it. As I eat it, I taste it. But is that everything that's going on? No. Think of all the different things that are happening right now that we can't perceive with our senses. Above the visible light spectrum is ultraviolet light. It's certainly emitting ultraviolet light. We have no sensation of that at all. We can't see it. Infrared light, that's heat. It's warm to a certain temperature. There is infrared coming off of it. That's kind of what it would look like if we could see it. But we can't. X-ray. Tiny, 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 tiny bit of X-ray emission. Probably coming off the bowl because it's ceramic. Microwave. That's way up there in frequency. Microwave, a little bit of microwave radiation. We have no perception of that at all. Radio waves. That's the highest. A little bit maybe coming off the metal. Magnetic field, it's on a metal trivet, so there's probably a little bit of magnetic activity in the iron in that trivet. And then there's one more that I don't have a slide for, and that is radiation. Just a ceramic bowl, there's certainly a tiny bit of radiation coming off of that. If you have granite countertops in your home, there's definitely a little bit of radiation coming off of those. So, to answer that, we cannot know about everything that's coming off of this. It's pretty obvious, but it leads us to the next question. Is what we perceive at least objective? What does an object really look like? Do we perceive reality as it really is? Those 3 questions, they're slightly different, but they kind of cover the general idea of where I want to go with this. Okay. Let's go to something really interesting to try to answer this question. This is one of the best slides there is. Look at this. How do animals perceive the world? I picked a few that are really interesting. Let's go to the dog. Dogs have 40 times the number of scent receptors in their nose that we do. And their perception of smell is even more than that, more than ours. They say 40 to 1 million times the ability to pick up smells a dog has over us. Dogs are so sensitive to smell, there's sometimes some types of human cancer that dogs can actually smell. So when my dog wants to smell the poop on the ground, I let him do it. He knows something I don't know. They have more, you know, there's rods and cones in the eyeballs. They have more rods in their eyeballs, so they have better low light vision than us. There's fewer cones, though, so they see less detail. And the color is flatter. So they don't see, they couldn't read, even if they could read, they couldn't read. It requires too much fine resolution vision. They have better peripheral vision than we do, but they have worse depth perception. So if you're way out, 100 yards out in a field, they can't really tell how far you are like we can. So how would a dog perceive this bowl of potato chips or corn chips? He'd ignore the bowl, ignore the trivet, and eat the chips, right? Because they smelled really good, and he could smell them from the other side of the football field. All right, now we get a little weirder. Let's talk about bats. I've been reading about bats. It's really interesting. They have this ability called echolocution, where, well, let me start over. When we sense the outside world, we are perceiving photons in the case of light, sound waves in the case of sound. In the case of smell, it's just particles of the food that are in the air around us that we can perceive. But those signals all come from the outside world, right? Bats use echolocation. They actually emit a high-frequency sound and bounce that sound off an object, receive the signal coming back from that object with enough clarity to be able to fly at 50 miles an hour. And if that thing is a fly or a rock, he can tell the difference based on not his sight, but how those sound waves bounce back and he perceives them. I can't even imagine what the mental picture in his mind looks like for him to be able to do that, but that's what they can do. Now, they say that bats' vision is really bad. It's actually not bad. It's bad in the daytime, at dusk and twilight, and in the morning, it's actually better than ours. That's why they're out a lot right after the sun goes down or before the sun goes up. Vampire bats, there really is such a thing, they have such an acute sense of temperature that they can tell the difference between a spot on the neck of their prey. There's a slight temperature difference between the vein and the area next to it that's not the vein. What is it, a quarter of a degree or half a degree or whatever that is, they can actually detect that difference and fly and get the vein. We have no idea what that would be like. Well, how would this appear to a bat? I'll leave it up to you to try to figure it out. A bee. This is fascinating. How does one bee know if a flower has already been pollinated by another bee? It's not like the first one gets to it and then the next 1,000 land on it and realize that it's already pollinated. They have a way of knowing. As they fly, they develop a positive charge. And when they fly over a flower, the flower is negatively charged very slightly if it has not been pollinated. And they can detect that negative charge with these little hair-like things on their legs. So if they fly over the flower and those little hair-like things on their legs go like this, they land on the flower because they know it hasn't been pollinated. If they don't do this, they go to the next one. What would that be like? What would these potato chips, corn chips, look like to a bee? A black ghost knife fish. Okay? This is another example of an animal that emits something into the environment that then and then can sense it back, like the bat. In this case, they emit an electric field from this thing in their tail, and for about 3 feet around them, if anything goes into that field, they can sense a disturbance in the force. For lack of a better way of saying it, they're Star Wars fish. Yeah. So I don't know how they would think about those corn chips because corn chips aren't usually underwater and knife fish are, but you get the idea. Bacteria. Bacteria are the simplest standalone organisms. Viruses are simpler, but they don't live on their own. Bacteria live on their own. They're a single cell, and yet some species of bacteria actually have vision. They can actually detect light and move towards or away from it depending on whether they see it as a threat or not. I found this really cool chart, How Slime Sees. And the author of this paper actually believes that they can form, if you see it on the lower right-hand corner, where it says cyanobacteria, not just light or dark, but an actual sort of out-of-focus image of whatever is in front of them. It's amazing. Here's another thing bacteria can do. Many species of bacteria that we have no sense of at all, they actually can align themselves with the north and south magnetic pole. So they have the ability to sense the electromagnetic field of the Earth. We have no sense of that at all. Here's the next one. If you ever want to, if you believe that aliens have landed on the Earth and have populated the world from some other planet, this is the animal they brought. Octopuses are the, read up on them, they're the weirdest animals that exist. They have, their entire body is involved in perception. They have about 500 million neurons, which is equivalent to a dog, but more than half of them are out on their tentacles. 300 million neurons that aren't in their head. They're out here. So imagine being able to detect light with all of these different sense organs and be able to move them in relation to each other. It would be like having our two eyeballs that are on like antenna like this that could go like this, right? Only there's more than two, there's like hundreds. And yet your brain can put all that image together and make sense out of it. That's what an octopus can do. And what they've discovered is that if you're into computers, there's two different kinds of systems. David could tell me what I'm talking about here, but there's systems like your laptop where everything happens, all the memory, all the computing happens in one place. That's kind of the way our brains work. Octopuses more resemble a distributed network where there's stuff all over the place. Because if you cut the tentacle off an octopus, it still continues to function for a while as if it has its own mind and will. So it's like the brain or the way that it functions is distributed throughout the whole animal. We can't even imagine what that would be like. Yeah. Yet it only has one light receptor in its eye. So it only sees in black and white. But it changes, it's able to actually change the size, the width of the eyeball. So it can detect color, but in the same way that a prism diffracts light, it can, certain wavelengths of light are visible to it at different lengths that the eyeball adjusts itself to. So if it wants to detect blue, it's really short. If it wants to detect red, it's really wide. But in the eye, there's only one type of receptor. It's black and white. So they see color in an entirely different way than we see color. So this is, there's going to be two or three things that I'm going to say that may be kind of unsettling. So the first one is, there is no objective answer to the question, what does something really look like? Because it depends on the thing itself that we're looking at, this. It has reality, it's really there. But it looks entirely different to different kinds of animals. So what does it really look like? Only God can answer that question. Because for us, it depends on our perceptual abilities to be able to see it. If we had the echolocution, I've messed it up three times now, that the bat has, we would perceive those corn chips entirely different than we perceive them. So there is no objective way to describe that bowl of potato corn chips from our perception. Where does our perception come from? Ooh, this is going to get really creepy. Got a nice red rose we cut from the garden of the guy next door. Is the rose red? I'm not going to answer these questions. Okay? Some of them are obvious, some of them aren't. I want you to think about it for a minute. How do you know? How do you know that that's red? Because ever since you were a little kid, somebody told you it's red. And everything you read, and you, it's been confirmed a million times in things you read and stuff you look at and the way other people talk, but that's the only way that you know it's red, isn't it? Where does its redness come from? Okay, look at this chart here. The one on the right, how does the eye work? Okay, you can see that there is a, I wish I could have found one with a red rose, but that one's got a green apple. The photons are bouncing off this red rose or the green apple and going into the eyeball, right? We see that. Are those photons red? No, that's just physics. That's just the vibration of a particular frequency of photons. Then that image in your eyeball is changed to an electrochemical signal. In the optic nerve, the eyeball transmits that signal into the brain. Is that electrochemical signal red? No. That's just chemistry. That's just biology, right? So where does this vivid, amazing redness in this rose come from that we all see? It's created in the mind. We've already said that there is no objective way to describe this, right? This is red because this is the way our brain sees it, not because it's inherently red. Now, that may freak you out, but don't let it. We will get to something more settled. There's a really good analogy on the left. We're all familiar when we used to have dish antenna on top of our roof. And it would go through a cable to the TV, and the TV would produce light, and we'd watch the TV. Okay? Is the signal from the satellite to the antenna visible light? No, it's just radio waves. Is the signal from the antenna then to the TV? Is that visible light? No. It's light when the TV changes the image into a visible light signal, and then we can see it. So that's what our brain is doing. The redness, the vividness, the color, what we see is color, and every other sense that we have is the way our brain puts it together. When I'm talking and I'm producing sound waves that you're hearing and your brain figures it out, that's just sound that's vibrating at a certain frequency. You're taking the meaning from it in your mind. It inherently has no meaning in it. It's how you interpret it. All of the senses are the same way. Touch is different because we're actually making contact. But smell, if you think about it, to even taste. Our brain is interpreting what it receives as taste or smell or sight or whatever it is. Now, here's another one that's going to might be hard. After all everything I've said, you might have the question, is what we perceive consistent? Do we all perceive things the same? Let's go back to this red rose. We all agree it's red. We've been told this color is red since we were little kids. You look it up in the dictionary, it might have under red, and it might have a rose, because this is a pretty classic way of describing it. But do you see that red the same way I see it?
I seriously doubt it.
Yeah. There is no way we can do like a screen share or a Vulcan mind meld with our brain and for me to know how you perceive that. You may see it as what I think of as blue, or you may see it as green, or you may see it in some way that my brain doesn't do that. We can both talk about it being red, and we can talk about how beautiful it is, and we can go look at the roses at the Arboretum or wherever we want to go to, and we might have something in common in appreciating the beauty, but do each of us perceive it the same way? There's no way to know. Here's a really interesting condition. How many people have ever heard of synesthesia? Here's what synesthesia is. It's really interesting. It's having a mental impression that is usually related to one sense, but is perceived by some as another sense. About 4% of the population have some form of synesthesia. About 1 in 25. And it's not considered a disorder. Okay, that's really important. It's just an example of how the brain works differently. Some people, and I've got several examples here so you get an idea, but this one David found online. Some people, when they see a number in writing, like reading a book, they always see that number in color. And it's consistent. If they see a 2, it's always yellow to them. And people that have synesthesia just think this is the way the world is. They have to be explained to later on that that's not normal. Here's some examples, and these are actual examples. I didn't make them up. You hear the word city spoken, and you get the taste in your mouth of strawberries. You see the number 2 as yellow. You smell pears when someone calls your name. You get a pain in your hand when you hear a whistle sound. You see different notes in a musical composition as different colors. So when the concert is playing, you go to the Hollywood Bowl, you're listening to the music, people with that type of synesthesia are also seeing colors that relate to the music. Yeah. Sounds like they've been on drugs or something, but when they see the color blue, they get a taste in their mouth from that color. And again, this is not considered a disorder. This is just the way some people's brains are built. The people that have it tend to think it's pretty cool. Many people who have color synesthesia like this, you see the 2 numbers at the bottom, 84 and 56, because they see colors that are specific to the numbers and consistent, they can memorize a number not just by saying 56, but they can say it, they can memorize it by pink-green. Here's another one that's a really interesting. This is called blind sight, and I don't know if this video is going to work. Let's play the video. Well, I'll describe it first, and maybe there's a little bit of a sound embedded in here, and maybe it'll come through. Okay, so it's not going to work. So here's what blind sight is. There are some people who are absolutely clinically blind. It can be proven. They cannot see anything. Whatever light is coming into the eye is not being transmitted through the optic nerve to the brain. But they can walk an obstacle course and not run into anything. And they themselves cannot describe how they can do it. So here's a guy doing it. This guy is blind, and yet somehow he knows where that stuff is. David, how can I freeze that? Because I don't want to go to the next slide yet. Is it just going to continue to play? Okay, there it is. All right, here's one of the most important things I want to say. Remember the chart that I showed you that had the apple and the eyeball and the optic nerve and the brain? How many of you are familiar with the term black box? Maybe Darwin's Black Box, a book by Michael Behe. What is a black box? A black box is a term for something like a computer or some mechanical thing that you can look and see that there's input and there's output, but you don't know how it works. Our mind is a black box. That optic nerve is connected to the brain, right? And the brain transmits the nerve signals throughout the brain, but also to our mind. Now, my belief is that the mind is what we think of as our conscious world, is to a great extent immaterial. It cannot be explained scientifically or materially. And I actually have what I would say is really good evidence for that. There are, you look at near-death studies, people who have had near-death experiences where they're on an operating table, they start to die, something goes wrong, their experience is that they leave their body, and at some point, if they're resuscitated, they go back into their body, they wake up and they tell the story. Now, it would be really easy to say that that's just the brain doing some weird thing, right? There's no way to prove that, but here's some. They're called veridical experiences, which means they relate to the real world. There's an example of a woman who left her body. Her experience was she floated up high into the room, and she noticed on top of one of the pieces of equipment in the hospital was a 12-digit serial number. And after she came back and told the story, she said, well, I'm OCD. OCD people memorize big numbers. You just kind of have to do that. So while she was out of her body, she memorized this 12-digit number. She came back. She relayed the stories to people who were not necessarily believers. Now, think about what this means, okay? If this is really true, and there's thousands and thousands of examples of these, there's actually a journal, a peer-reviewed scientific journal that's dedicated to near-death studies. So this is not a fringe thing anymore. But think about what that means. Not only did she see something that corresponded with the real world while she was flatlined physically on the operating table, she was able to experience it, which means where did the photons of light from that number go? If she was immaterial on the operating table, what was perceiving those photons? Secondly, she remembered it. She didn't just have the experience, she remembered it, which means some part of our memory must be immaterial because she came back into her body and still had that memory. Where was that memory in the time between when it happened and when she came back into her body? So anyway, my point here is that these near-death experiences are getting more and more common. And it seems to me the only way to argue for materialism anymore, the idea that everything is just physics, you know, or as Carl Sagan used to say, the universe is all there was, all there is, and all there ever will be. There really is good evidence that it's just not true, that there is a spiritual side to things. My belief is that the mind is a black box. It's partly the physical, our physical brain. It's also partly an immaterial thing that we cannot identify. We can't know how it works. And so if someday, Bud, we could disconnect your eyes and your optic nerve and just unplug it and plug it into my brain, there's still no guarantee that I would perceive things visually the same way you would. Because Maybe the difference is in the mind. Maybe the difference is in how I perceive it, even if the signals from the optic nerve are identical. So again, there's no way to know if each one of us are perceiving the world similarly or the same as any other person. Yeah.
So what's the explanation for this? The so-called scientific...
All right, but I got a question. We'll get you on the process.
It's not working.
We're going to record.
Wait, can you use the arrows?
No. It's stuck. I perceive that my computer is frozen. Maybe I'm wrong. Oh. Oh no.
Hit the space bar.
No, it's not responding.
Well, do I need to do this without?
It may or may not crash.
Oh, thanks. Okay, we're gonna restart. Just like my presentation here, it may or may not crash. Okay.
Open up.
No, you open it. I'm going to keep talking. So here's another little fact that our minds, my mind, your mind, Bud, are completely causally disconnected from each other, right? What I think, what goes on in my head, does not affect what you think or goes on in your head unless we communicate with each other. So it's another little piece of evidence that there's no way that I can, that we can know if we're seeing the world, perceiving the world in the same way. Thank you, David. Yeah.
Ross, when do you want any questions today, or you want to go on?
How much time do I have, Mark?
Well, till 2:45 at latest.
Okay. I've got a whole nother section for next week, but maybe, yeah. Let me do one more question. One more of my questions, and then we'll stop and we'll take questions
all
for
right.
Next, and then I'll continue next week.
Okay.
Okay. So the next, so I've kind of beat all this up, right? We can't know everything there is to know. We can't be sure that we are even seeing it objectively, and we don't even know if we're all seeing it the same way. Well, what can we say? Is there a yes to any of these questions? Is what we perceive useful? And here's where we start to get into the apologetic value. The answer is absolutely yes. There's some theories of mind that say that the outside world does not really exist, that the only thing that exists is minds, and we all make this stuff up. I don't believe that. That's crazy. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This bowl of corn chips is real. Doesn't really look like that, because it doesn't really look like anything. But it exists outside of my mind, outside of your mind. It's a real object. If you don't believe it, smash the bowl into my head, and you see the effect of it, okay? So this, I don't want to go there. It's not like I'm trying to say that we're all just minds. Some people do that. But what we do perceive, what does it give us? Well, for one thing, it gives us safety. I know where that step is, and I know when I walk. It may not be what the step actually looks like. We don't know what that step really looks like, but I know it's there. I know where it is. I know if I step wrong, I can fall. It tells us about food, doesn't it? Our stomach tells us we're hungry. We can smell food. We know if it's good food. We know if it's bad food. We know if it's food that's going bad because of our nose. We can detect movement. Without our senses, we couldn't have any relationships, could we? We wouldn't even know that anybody else existed. Knowledge of boundaries. We know what we can do and what we can't. We can't not eat and drink water for days. We can't treat people badly and expect to live well. There's just certain realities that the outside world, there's like the tyranny of reality, you could call it, right? The outside world presents us with boundaries that we can't go past, which has to do with truth, doesn't it? How could we tell the truth without our senses to perceive the outside world? And one of the greatest things is, tells us about God. Mark, I'm going to finish. I only got about 10 minutes. So the last question is, so what? Right? I've told you all these really cool facts, and maybe you'll go home and study it a little bit, but how does this relate to our apologetics, to what Reasons to Believe tries to teach, to us as believers and how we relate to God and how we interact with each other? Number one, patience with others. Okay? For all the different reasons that we have to be patient with each other, here's another one. How many of us know just really odd people, right? You know they just see the world differently. How many of you are odd people? I'm one, for sure. I think that with this knowledge that each of us, we're not perceiving the world as it really is, and each of us may be having a very different experience of the world, we need to be really patient and a lot more just better listeners with each other. Okay? Spend time with somebody. How do you see the world? What does that look like to you? What does that mean to you? We're going to get into meaning next week. We haven't done that at all. Because when we see something, it immediately presents us with meaning, doesn't it? We can't see anything that doesn't have meaning. That's next week. So being patient with each other, and this has actually been happening to me. Since I put this talk together and I've been thinking about that, it's like, we're not supposed to judge each other. I can't judge the other person's intentions, and even though I want to, it's a lot more fun, it's way more comfortable, I really want to feel right, but here's another reason why we can't do that. I just don't know what that other person is experiencing. Second, patience with others brings what? Humility. I can't even see the world as it really is. I don't know what you're thinking or feeling. The only thing I've got that's really, truly dependable is my relationship with God. I better shut up and listen and, tune down the arrogance. And number three is all of this enhances our relationship with God. And here's where, this is the main point I want to make. So even though color and all of the senses, the image of that is formed in our mind, even though there's no objective way to describe an object, even though we don't see all things the same, what God has given us, this visual experience, the olfactory experience, experience of touch, of making love to our partners, of all of this sensory experience is really so much more extravagant than what he needed to give us. And I believe is a really good argument against evolution, because evolution would not have done anything this extravagant. Let me make my point. Here's a fabulous picture of some beautiful mountains that David found online. It's a great shot. Look at the color, the depth. We can see so much in there. But imagine if what we saw was just, we couldn't ever see it clearly. What if everything we saw was out of focus? Could we still relate to each other? Could we still eat? Could we still know where this is and not, where the step is? Could we get along? Yeah, we can get along. We could, right? What if it looked like this? It's the same picture. But it's just stark and kind of ugly, isn't it? This is probably what evolution would have given us had it even developed sight in the first place. Would be just some kind of minimal thing to get us along. How about this? Just gray, no color. Or this. Not even gray, just black or white. Once again, this is enough to get us by, isn't it? We could live with this. Or that. Or what if we only had one photoreceptor in our brain and all it did? Or what if it was just really dark? Wasn't vivid and colorful. What if we only had one photoreceptor in our brain and all we could see, everything was blue? There's no red or green or anything. Could we get by? Yeah, we could get by. But this isn't what we see. What do we see? We see this. Thank you, Jesus. And it's the same thing with all the senses. They're so much more extravagant than what we need. Or the sound to be able to hear music. The visual sense to be able to see color and depth and everything sharp and in focus. To be able to touch, to be able to smell. It's what God has given us is like a starving man asking for a crust of bread and he gets a 10-course banquet instead. Enjoy the world. Enjoy the world. You don't think of the word sensual very often in relation with God, but I want to use that word. God is a sensual God in the sense that he's given us this amazing, not only given us the world, but this amazing sense to be able to perceive it that is so much more enhanced than what it needed to be. This is why I said, I hope that you will literally see the world differently after this talk. Enjoy the world, enjoy the food, enjoy going to the movie, enjoy your partner, enjoy the visual experience, but don't make it God. How do you know if you're not making it God? If you're not making it God, every other thought you have will be, thank you, Jesus. If you make it God, you don't think about God. You just appreciate the beauty. But that's not where we're supposed to go, is it? Enjoy the world. It's a sensual world. And thank God for it every moment. This has made a big difference to me. I wake up, I open my eyes, and when I'm thinking about it, a lot of times during my day, I really thank the Lord for this visual sense that I have that's so much more crazy and wild and amazing than it needed to be. I bet you've never thought about it this way. I never had before. The senses that he has given us, sight, sound, smell, touch, taste, they're actually kind of in a distance order, aren't they? How far can you see? Well, if you know what Hugh Ross says, we can see to the literally see to the beginning of the almost the beginning of the Big Bang. We can see those stars that are 13.8 billion years old. The light has taken that long to for that photon to finally park in my eyeball. I can see that far. We can all see that far. Sound is shorter, right? How far away is the loudest sound you could hear? Well, they say that volcanic eruption just a few months ago on the island of Tonga was able to be heard 600 miles away. That it was the loudest sound on Earth this century. I don't know how they know that, but if you can hear a sound 600 miles away, that's pretty amazing. But normally, sounds are maybe hundreds of feet, dozens of feet. Then smell. How far do you have to be to smell this rose? Usually within a few inches. Sometimes if smells are really terrible, like a skunk, you can smell them 30 or 40 feet away. Touch. You have to be intimate with somebody. You have to be right next to them to be able to feel a touch. And taste is the most intimate sense of all, right? It actually has to be inside of us. I never thought about it, that God has given us these senses that are in that cover these different distances. The rest of my talk is several Bible verses, and I want to go through them really quickly. Romans 1:19-20, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. I'm expanding on this. My argument goes a little further than this. Not only are we clearly perceiving it, the way God gave us to perceive it is evidence of his existence. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to the last slide because I got a great quote. I'm going to close with that. We'll do the rest of these verses next week. How many of you are familiar with a Christian author named G.K. Chesterton? Look, this quote is perfect. "Here dies another day, during which I have had eyes, ears, hands, and the great world around me. And with tomorrow begins another. Why am I allowed two?" Thank you for your kind attention. And whatever time we have left, I'll take some questions.
Okay. All right, Ross. Just a couple of comments online here. Keith Wilson says, J.P. Morgan deals with issues of near-death experience. So does Susan Lamb. She says Gary Habermas also does. So
yeah.
If anybody wants to look further into that, near-death experiences or NDEs. Valerie asked a question. Seems like chaos. How can we be sure of anything?
Because we have certainty in a God who loves us. And I think we know that even though we're not perceiving things as they really are or hearing them, it at least is consistent. And God has embedded in that consistency some reliability that we have on the different ways of doing things. So I know, Mark, I know your voice. I know what you sound like. You always have the same voice. It's not like you're different one day than the next. So there is consistency in the natural world.
Does anybody in the class have a question? Okay, Norm's got one here. Jamie, I'll give you mine.
Yes, looking at the rows, the speaking strictly from a scientific point of view now, not a spiritual point of view, which is a whole other approach. But if you look at the rows, one thing we know scientifically is that it gives off certain wavelengths.
Right.
Those wavelengths describe what that rose looks like.
Correct.
And we do, and so, and the one thing that we do know is that's what our eyes are sensitive to. Our eyes are sensitive to in receiving those wavelengths.
Correct.
So the question becomes then, what we do with those wavelengths.
Correct.
That whatever happens in our mind. Okay, so I guess I'm kind of agreeing with what you say here, is that we do know that much. That's kind of where the definition of our knowledge, definition of our knowledge ends, extremely kind of what we receive. And whatever else we goes on in our mind, that's what we aren't familiar with. And like you say, you may see it as gray, or it's a different perception for you. The other thing I'd like to say is that. You address this as all of this refinement as something that all this refinement tells us of is an argument against evolution. Did I say that correctly?
I would say that's how I think about it, but I'll be a little more circumspect and say I think it's better. I think the facts of the case that I made are better explained by a creator than they are by an evolutionary process.
Yes, I think we'd all agree with that. All I was going to say is that, in that regard, we don't know. Arguing then from the evolutionary point of view is that I could say, well, yes, those things are required. They are part of what is required to evolve. You know, and so that I mean, I don't believe it, but that's what I might argue, and the I guess that's kind of the two points I wanted to make.
Yeah, let me say one thing about the evolutionary thing. Evolutionary science has gotten to the point where they really just tell stories.
Yeah.
If somebody says this vivid color sense that we have of the world in high definition is necessary for our existence, I would say show me from a biological standpoint why that's true. Because you can make up a story to show how it could be, or you could make up a story to show how we would all have just stayed bacteria, because they're the most, they have the best ability to survive a wider range of environmental conditions. That's my argument against evolution is, if it was really true, any given complex organism would de-evolve to a bacteria, because they're the ones that are going to be the most likely to reproduce and continue.
Okay.
So you can make up stories all you want. Show me. It's science. Show me.
Yes. I can say one more thing, and that is the lady said that we hardly know anything. And you know, there's a very common philosophical statement that says, I think, therefore I am.
Right.
Basically, and I forget who the...
Descartes.
Descartes, yeah. So, and that kind of comes down in the same point of view as we see in 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13 tells us that... tells us how limited our knowledge of reality is. God tells us that in the Bible, that we do not know everything. He says, then you will know even as I also know you, or something like that. But the message there is, to me anyway, gives us a real limitation, sets the bounds on what we know. God set that bound for us.
Yeah. Thank you, Norm.
Okay. Keith Wilson has a question. It sort of goes along with Valerie's question, so be ready for that. Do we as persons have direct access to the real world despite the data failings of our physical senses and thus our interpretive errors?
I guess I would have to say, how do you define direct access? I have access to the photons that are bouncing off this that go into my eyes. I have access to the nerve signal that's coming from my hand right now as I touch it. I can taste it. I guess direct access, the closest thing to that would be touch, because there's no intermediary. So I'd say yes, it's just all in how is that direct access interpreted.
Okay. Any more questions? Valerie's got one.
Okay, you know how you meet someone and you think to yourself, man, this person's really just a black and white kind of person, you know?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if, because of our various ways of perceiving things, like the scenery that you pointed out, if there are people indeed that, because of vision problems or, you know, just any number of aspects that make them see like those images that you projected, would that then affect their perception on life? I mean, would they really truly be literally a black and white kind of person? Or a person who is colorblind? I mean, there's red, green colorblindness,
right,
where those shades are all gray. So that would change your outlook literally when you see scenery or people or objects.
Right.
That might change your attitude, your emotional response.
And that's, I agree. How did Helen Keller perceive the world? She was blind and deaf, and yet she led a very full life. What were her mental images like? I can't imagine. But my point is that subtly we're all kind of like that, right? We all probably, our eyeballs are built differently. Some of us can focus better. Some of us see better at night. Some of us may see one color better than another color. The variations are infinite. We just can't know. We can't know the differences.
Yes, sir. One moment.
Name's Richard. I was wondering how this, the perception, is reflected in the dream state.
Wow. I haven't even thought about that. Explain more.
Well, when we dream, we dream memories, I suppose we could say, things that may or may not have happened. A week ago, I dreamt about a family reunion that I was participating in that never had happened. And I happened to walk into a room, and there were my grandmother and grandfather sitting, dressed in their nice clothes, and I was going to go up to say hello to them. But I was my age now of 71.
Uh-huh.
They've been gone since the 60s, wow. And yet I could see them. I think at times with dreams, some have said that women perceive dreams in color more than men do, and I can't remember if my sense of smell enters my dreams or not, but I don't think so. And then another side of the coin is, in Christian worship, how does the way we worship, the style of worship, involve some of our senses or all of our senses?
You know, I'll start with the second half. One of the verses that I didn't do is, let's see if I can, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him, Psalm 34. What I get from this verse is that our experience of God is supposed to be really intimate and really visceral. Like, you know, communion. He's in us. It's not this distant thing that's just in our head. This is God we're tasting and seeing. As far as next, let me answer your question a little bit. This week we've talked about perception, just the five senses and how stuff gets in there and how we perceive it. Next week, it's going to get even weirder. We're going to talk about the experience of that perception, okay? My own personal, I call it my personal sound and light show that I have, which is not only my perception, but the way my brain is built and the way what I pay attention to and the things that I tend to think about. And I think for me, I've never been one that felt like dreams meant much. I think God, you know, you listen to some people in the Muslim world, God uses dreams to people. Many people in the Muslim world have seen dreams or visions of Christ and have then become a follower of Christ because of those. So I think God certainly, and the Bible's filled with stories like that, God certainly can use dreams to tell us something specific if he chooses to. But generally, in my mind, it's just the brain, you know, letting off pressure somehow that makes up these images that somehow help us think the next day. I haven't studied it enough to really have a good answer for that. So,
I have one more question.
Yeah.
I know that as human beings, our gestation period is fairly long, but then the change of becoming alive and then being self-sufficient is so many years, perhaps 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
And part of the change is just the connection of our senses with our body. A baby sees images that are upside down and backwards.
Yeah.
And somehow we turn that around over a period of time, and somehow the baby within a little while learns to connect its finger with its mouth and things like that.
Right.
So have you thought about it in terms of the meaning of the development of perception?
Wow. Well, I know our perception is really plastic. It's very malleable. I saw this film once, the Moody Bible Institute. Remember them? And my dad would bring home these films, and we'd play them on a projector. And I remember one of them was this guy walked around for days with this camera on his head. This was way before computers. But what it did was it inverted the image of the world. So he was walking around for days with an upside down image of the world. He didn't take it off, right? And you know what happened after 3 or 4 days? He woke up one day and the image was right side up because the brain had figured out, this is what's going on, I need to invert the image. So without anything happening, he didn't do anything. The brain adapted and flipped the image. How adaptable is that? That's phenomenal.
Bud's got a question.
I'm familiar with that experiment. And to conclude that experiment, they actually, once he took that off for a few days, he saw everything upside down and backwards. And they confirmed that with other volunteers as well, that the exact same phenomena happened.
Yeah. It's amazing how the brain can adapt that. How much time do we have left, Mark? 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay.
We do have an online question.
Okay.
Yeah, Keith again from, I think he's in New Zealand. Keith says, are we ourselves separated from reality behind our senses, like, say, the Matrix? And just to add to that, you may recall Chuck Misler.
Yeah.
He always described our universe as a hologram.
Yeah.
And that heaven was the reality. So anyway, you want to address that? Are we in a matrix, as Keith was asking there?
The name that I've come up for this is like enhanced reality. Okay? I think that, like those slides I showed of the mountains and all the different ways we can see it, there's an infinite number of ways we could see it. This is the way that God has sovereignly decided to give us, each one of us, the way to see and perceive the world. So the world really exists. It's not like the Matrix in the sense that all of these things, like the reality of this bowl, is not made up in my head. The bowl's real. It's outside of my brain. But the way we perceive it is something that God has given us. So are we connected to the world directly? I like to think we are. I think that's the way the Bible teaches it, despite what I've said this afternoon. I think there is a spiritual connection that we have that is more than the physical connection. And I think some evidence for that is the ability of those people that have had near-death experiences to actually see. I think in some way they're perceiving the world, they're sensing the world in a direct way that isn't involved with photons. There's a spiritual something there that they're perceiving that is in actually more direct contact than the photons coming up. Because it's really easy to say, I'm just isolated, I'm all by myself, I'm standing here, I'm not really connected to anyone, I'm just receiving photons and sending out sound waves and I'm going to die completely alone, right? It's not the picture, that's the picture a physicist will tell you. It's not the picture the Bible paints. The picture the Bible paints is Holy Spirit is with us all the time in all circumstances. God is right here. And I think there is a way, a spiritual way, a non-physical way, that we are actually interacting with each other and with the world.
Okay. Well, we're about out of time, Ross.
Okay.
It's really been fun. Would you close us in prayer, please?
Yeah, you bet. Lord God, when we see the mountains and when I look at my wife and when I see the world outside that you've given us, Lord, I just praise you. Thank you for the beauty there, the reality, the sensuality. I ask, Lord, that I never forget about you during my day, that I'm always aware of this fantastic experience that you've given us of life, of seeing, of perceiving, of hearing, of interacting with other people. It's so exotic, it's so wild, it's so much more than you needed to give us, and I just thank you for that. I never want to take it for granted. Thank you, Lord, for each one of us here in the room and out there on the internet. Bless us each as we go our way this afternoon. In Jesus' name, amen.
Okay, thank you, everybody. Part two next week.
Part two next week.
Starring Ross Hoagland.
Yeah.
So please be online for that.
Yep. All right.